Hello, everyone, and welcome to Red Hawk Squawk, Exercise for Life, a podcast brought to you by Seattle University's Kinesiology Department. Kinesiology is the study of how the human body functions, and our department wants to share knowledge that will allow any body to function a little healthier, regardless of that body's shape, ability, age, gender, or race. Each of our podcasts will highlight a different aspect of our field and help translate existing research into everyday practice. Today, Andrew Skakoza, who's one of our graduate students, and I are joined by Dave Olson. Dave is a board-certified physician specializing in internal medicine. He's also a photographer, a filmmaker, a climber, a humanitarian, all with interest in the human adaptation to extreme environments. So today we have Dave on the podcast to talk to us about exercise at high altitude. Welcome, Dave. So I guess to start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Thanks so much for having me. As you said, Dave Olson, I'm a internal medicine physician. So I work as a hospitalist, which is a internal medicine doc who only sees people that are admitted to the hospital. A lot of people don't know what a hospitalist is, but if you don't get sent home from the ER, you kind of fall under my purview. I guess the reason that I'm on here talking about exercise at high altitude is that when I was a kid, I found a climbing rope in my dad's closet and started a line of questioning that ended up with him showing me, some slides from climbing in the Sierras in California, and that kind of stoked an interest in me about, for climbing, and kind of got him back into climbing, and everything really has just kind of sprung from there, really. My interest in high altitude physiology, has come about just because of my interest in my own, body and how I would feel at high altitude and the kinds of things that happen and wondering, why do I feel this way? Why does this happen? And then even things like photography and filmmaking, those were just kind of outgrowths of wanting to document, things that I was doing with my dad. I think I saved up money and bought my first camera when I was about 12. So in a way it's all kind of tied together.
Yeah. That kind of already answered my second question about, kind of where this all came from. You said you, got started on climbing, I guess, early on in life, but how did that progress to kind of this more mountaineering space that you've been pretty heavily involved with your research and your documentaries and all of that?
Yeah, it's just kind of one lucky break after another, I remember when you kind of get into climbing, mountaineering was kind of more my thing as opposed to, sport climbing, just because I like being out in the wilderness. I like, getting as far away from things as I can, and mountaineering is just kind of taking that to the logical extreme. And I've just kind of been lucky in that, I've met other people that had similar interests, and got invited to go to the Himalayas for the first time in about 2000. And I remember thinking, I'm not ready for that. I'm not there as a climber or whatever, and I can't remember who it was, but somebody just said, you'll never think that you're ready. It's climbing in these high mountains, it's just like climbing in the low mountains. It's just, you imagine chaining them together and climbing one after another. And then different projects, attracted attention. In 2009, I made a documentary about K2, the world's second highest peak. And just having made that film and getting it out there, has ended up producing new opportunities that actually started kind of popping up when I was in medical school, which I actually didn't start until I was 35. It was kind of a later in life decision to pursue that. And that's a whole other story too.
Yeah,
did that answer the question?
Yeah, totally. I guess to kind of piggyback off of that, I think Andrew had some questions on that documentary specifically. Andrew, you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's cool hearing your experience about going to the Himalayas for the first time. I'm sure it's kind of impossible to kind of prepare for something like that, being physiologically and just mentally too. But I kind of want to ask you a little bit about it's such a broad topic, and I'm sure you can talk about it for, you can have an entire course, you can probably have an entire department related to this kind of stuff, but I do want to ask you, and you don't have to go super in depth, just what happens physiologically to the body when you're at such extreme altitude or elevation?
Yeah, so the first thing that happens is simply an increase in respiration rate, actually preceded by an increase in heart rate. So, you know, these are just the simplest compensatory mechanisms to increase the amount of oxygen, you know, reaching tissues. So, you know, as you go up in altitude, you have this decrease in the partial pressure of oxygen. And so it takes a greater volume of blood to carry a similar amount of oxygen. So that's, you know, the kind of immediate response. And then in the simplest, you know, way of thinking about adaptation to high altitude is this increase in erythropoiesis. So an increase in the number of red blood cells. You know, the idea being to increase the oxygen carrying capacity of your blood. In the short term, you have an altitude mediated diuresis, which can be quite profound, actually. If you at times, you know, you'll find that you're urinating a lot, and this is simply a mechanism to concentrate your blood in order to get more red blood cells per milliliter of blood, and then that's kind of overtaken by growing more red blood cells and increasing the total red blood cell mass that your body has. And then, you know, from there, gosh, there are so many little things. The sensitivity of chemoreceptors to oxygen and to carbon dioxide are modulated. You know, one of the things that people will experience when they, you know, first go to high altitude. So, you know, when we're typically talking above 8,500 feet or about 3,500 meters is kind of where we think of high altitude as starting. So, you know, if you were to drive from sea level to Mount Rainier, for instance, and hike up to Camp Muir and go to sleep there, you likely would wake up numerous times throughout the night, kind of gasping for breath. And this is you know, a really common, I mean, this happens to, you know, 95% of people. And this is basically a mismatch between the sensitivity of your chemoreceptors and the environment. So you, because the partial pressure of oxygen is low, you need to breathe faster in order to supply yourself with enough oxygen. But by breathing faster, you blow off so much of the carbon dioxide that is in your bloodstream that you no longer are stimulating these chemoreceptors enough to cause yourself to initiate a breath. So it doesn't happen when you're awake, but when you're asleep, this leads to basically a period of hyperventilation, followed by a period of complete apnea where you're not taking any breaths at all until carbon dioxide levels build back up high enough that breathing is stimulated and you then I start hyperventilating again, and that often makes people either fully wake up or at least wake up enough that in the morning they feel pretty crummy from not having good sleep.
Yeah, that's a lot. and you mentioned Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier is about 14,000 feet, I believe.
Yeah.
It's
14,400 and change.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd mentioned that because I kind of want to bring to scale the expedition that you did on K2, and K2 is, I think, double the size of Mount Rainier. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. It is roughly exactly double. So at 8,611 meters, I always have to think about what that is in feet.
Right.
But it is, let me think real quick, what are we at there? 28,400 roughly. So it is almost exactly twice the height.
I can't imagine the physiological changes that are happening at this altitude. I want to kind of get a sense, like, obviously these physiological changes are happening. I want to kind of get a sense of what's happening mentally when you're up at that high of an altitude, at that extreme conditions, extreme temperatures. What's kind of going through your mind when you're up that high?
But that's such a vast question. So, from a psychological standpoint, that's my, my happy place, so I'm always kind of, I love being able to, look down on the terrain below me. You're at a point where you're often above the clouds. And there's something about the thin air. May just simply be that, that there's an element where of hypoxia that I think makes me feel sometimes kind of almost giddy. a really happy sort of joyous feeling, I guess, for me to be, working hard at those high altitudes. Physiologically, I think the main thing that people experience is basically exercise limitation, so there's you have breathlessness that, can be kind of alarming, because you're sitting there and you're not really thinking about it, and you might get up and, walk across base camp and, you're winded immediately with just, a tiny amount of effort. The big effect that altitude has on athletic performance is that it decreases it simply. But it decreases it in a way that can't be overcome past a certain point. So, although you acclimatize, you feel subjectively better while exercising, your actual objective exercise capacity is reduced in a very straightforward and linear fashion with increasing hypoxia. And, interestingly, this is mostly a centrally mediated phenomenon, in that, when you replicate this in the lab and you either have people, exercising, say, on a bike, or if you are simply electrically stimulating muscle tissue, you'll find that people, quit exercising from exhaustion at a point where, if you electrically stimulate the muscle is still able to exercise. So there is a central mechanism that reduces your motor output, that reduces your maximum heart rate. And that is something that is, still being heavily researched, because it's not, very well understood, but it is, you know, likely, you know, a protective mechanism, basically. You know, it's basically your brain putting the brakes on your heart rate and putting the brakes on exercise so that you don't completely outstrip the ability to supply oxygen to your muscles, especially in your heart. You know, you can imagine that, you know, that's, it's not good to have your heart deprived of oxygen. So that's kind of a hot topic of research and something that has kind of always fascinated me, that you just can't get your heart rate above a certain level. You know, you might be able to get your heart into the 180s or 190s at sea level, but you go to high altitude, you may not be able to even get it to 150. And so wow. the reduction in exercise is actually correlates with basically your stroke volume of your heart and how much cardiac output you can generate.
Dave, I want to circle back to your research here in a minute, but I have a question about kind of at what point as you go up in altitude does this really start to affect our bodies physiologically? I mean, I grew up in Southern California, very close to sea level, just like we are here in Seattle. And I moved up to Greeley, Colorado for graduate school, which is just shy of 5,000 feet. And even at that, I started to feel, you know, of course not altitude sickness or anything to those extremes, but, you know, I went from working out 5 days a week to moving to, you know, taking a 2-week break, going to sub 5,000 feet and being able to barely move without sucking wind, right? So we compare that to, you know, what we see at Mount Rainier, just over 14,000 feet, you know, compared to what you see in the Himalayas. I mean, at what point do you really start to see even just the start of these physiological effects, and where does it really start to take over? And I think that kind of leads into the next question about, you know, we talk about performance and we have all these ideas about, you know, train high, live low, or train low, live high. I guess, can you speak to that?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. So even at 5,000 feet, so in a city like Denver, you know, people that are going there straight from sea level will notice, you know, they'll notice it, you know, going up a flight of stairs, you'll feel a little bit winded perhaps. I see people, you know, in the hospital here, I'm in Salt Lake City right now. We're 4,000 something. And I have truckers who'll tell me, you know, oh yeah, every time I go to Denver or I come here, I get really out of breath, and they end up, you know, getting admitted to the hospital for exacerbations of heart failure that are basically provoked by their body's response to the change in altitude and the relative decrease in oxygen, which leads to a cascade of physiologic effects that for someone with you know, a decreased heart function can cause, you know, really distressing changes, pulmonary edema, and things like that. It's interesting to me because it, you know, it looks just like high altitude pulmonary edema. You know, it's got the same kind of setup, but sort of different reasons in terms of people that, you know, that have congestive heart failure. But I nerd out about it. And my colleagues are like, yeah, whatever. It's just heart failure. No big deal. But that is an altitude that you, for the most part, completely become accustomed to. You know, when you start to get above, you know, 8,500 feet, 10,000 feet, you can also, you know, acclimatize so that your athletic performance is pretty similar. But, you know, at 10,000 feet, you're not going to be able to exercise as hard as you would be at sea level. And, you know, above 17,000 feet, although you will have a lot of acclimatization, you are never going to, you know, even approach what you can do performance wise at sea level. And in fact, you know, above 17,000 feet, you're basically in a state of deterioration. And this is why, you know, if you look around the world, there is nowhere where there are permanent settlements above, you know, 17,000 feet. I think the highest inhabited places in the world, you know, top out somewhere around 15,000 feet. And that's simply because it's a kind of a functional limitation. In terms of training, so this is, yeah, that this is like a hot topic, right? You know, because everybody thinks like, oh, well, so, you know, do you want to live high, train high? Do you want to live low, train high? Live high, train low? I'm not sure that I'm not sure if there is a perfect answer, but I think these days most people kind of think that you get the best performance if you live high, but you train low. So if you are, you know, living in and acclimatized to an environment that's, you know, 8,000 feet, 9,000 feet, really only possible if you live in Colorado. So we're talking about Colorado people. If you, you know, really want to train hard, you need to go to a lower altitude. And in fact, somebody that I have climbed with on a couple expeditions was living in Colorado Springs. She was in the military. And so she would actually take advantage of access to a hyperbaric chamber. So she would go and exercise in a hyperbaric chamber because she could get much higher heart rates and exercise much harder with that higher partial pressure of oxygen. And so that kind of gives you the best of both worlds. But it's hard to do, right? I mean, because most of the time getting from, not everybody can live at high altitude one. And if you live at high altitude, it's usually pretty far to get to the low altitude.
Yeah, I think physiologically that makes sense. I remember growing up in Southern California and I wasn't that far from Big Bear. And there were a lot of boxers from the LA area that would go up to Big Bear and train all the time. Ian, and I didn't know a ton about kind of physiology or exercise physiology at the time. So I always thought that was really interesting. So, yeah.
I mean, it definitely, so just going, you know, going to, I mean, you know, training at high altitude, you know, it's not that it has, you know, bad effects. You know, the hypoxia and working in hypoxia does stimulate, you know, the production of red blood cells and stuff like that, but you have to get enough exposure to hypoxia that it actually makes a difference. And so there's a lot of things that get sold, like hypoxia masks, for instance, which basically just are flow restrictors. You know, there are, you know, hypoxic tents that are supposed to help you kind of pre-acclimatize. But there's not a lot of great data, you know, saying that these things work, you know, because you need to have that hypoxia for, you know, 18 hours a day, you know, to really get the full effect of the acclimatization.
Yeah, that's definitely, I've definitely seen some people wearing hypoxia masks or high altitude masks in the gym. And I've always wondered, like, are they really effective? Like, I don't know, you know, so.
It looks super uncomfortable, right?
It does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially a lot of them.
Go ahead, Nicole.
I was gonna say, I went to the gym with a guy in Colorado that used to wear one of those regularly. And I'm like, you're already around 5,000 feet. You know, what more is this really doing for you when you wear it for an hour at a time?
Yeah.
It just seems silly.
I mean, and I don't know. So I don't know if there's data out there. I would love to know. It looks like marketing to me. I don't know. I could be wrong. There are, you know, there is, you know, one thing that I actually purchased for myself one time just to try is basically a flow restrictor that is designed to increase the strength of your respiratory muscles. You know, the idea being that at very high altitude, you reach a threshold where your work of breathing is consuming more oxygen than your increase in ventilation provides. So, you know, usually you up to a certain point hyperventilation, you get a net gain in the amount of oxygen that you're going to have available to your body's tissues. But, you know, at a certain point, you're working so hard just on breathing that you no longer are getting any gains from it. And so the idea is that you know, training your respiratory muscles, you might be a little bit more efficient at that kind of upper end of respiration. But again, I don't know that there's any data out there that has been collected that really demonstrates whether that works or not. I don't know.
Sure. So we talked a little bit about training and I guess high altitude training and kind of training for like high altitude expeditions. I'm curious in terms of the how you kind of fuel your body during expeditions like this. I mean, these expeditions can take weeks to months, and you're exercising, you're using a lot of fuel. I kind of want to know what goes into like fueling your body for a huge expedition like this.
So, you know, the conventional wisdom is carbohydrates, because carbohydrates are utilized in a more oxygen efficient manner than our, you know, lipids or proteins. There's a, you know, there's a down regulation of oxidative metabolism at high altitude. And actually over the long run, you know, 30 to 60 days of acclimatization, if you look at muscle biopsy samples, people actually have a lower density of mitochondria in their muscle tissue than they, you know, did before this, these expeditions. And that is because the, you know, the glycolytic pathway is more efficient. If you look at people, so a whole other can of worms is people who are adapted to altitude, you know, from having lived there for generations. And the primary example of that is people of Tibetan or Sherpa descent, which is the longest high altitude resident population on Earth. And they have, you know, unique physiology that is the genetic basis of which is still being elucidated. But one thing that you would find is a lower density of mitochondria, you know, so basically a preference for glycolytic pathways as opposed to oxidative phosphorylation, oxidative, you know, lipid metabolism, stuff like that. So that's a conventional wisdom. But what it actually comes down to, though, is whatever you can palate or whatever you find palatable, because a lot of people find that hypoxia diminishes their appetites. And so the most important thing is just that you have food that you want to eat. You're never going to be able to eat enough calories to actually compensate for the calories you're burning. Even, you know, for, you know, like an expedition like to Denali, for instance, where, you know, much of it, you're not at, you know, really, really extreme altitudes, but you're working really hard. You know, if you're burning 6,000 calories a day, you're not going to eat 6,000 calories, which I didn't really, I don't think I really realized that until I tried. And I realized that, you know, you're just never going to, you can't eat that much in a day. So you're going to lose weight, and people do. And people have estimated that, you know, in the upper areas of Everest, for instance, that, you know, you may be you know, burning 10,000 calories a day. And a lot of that is just based, you know, your baseline metabolic rate going up, you know, to compensating for the altitude and cold and things like that.
So how many calories a day are you eating on the mountain? Because it seems like you can, I mean, you certainly can't eat that much in that day, but
25,
you also
maybe.
Can't pack that much.
I'm trying to think. I mean, you know, so for an expedition like a trip to Denali, you know, you know, because you plan ahead. And so you know exactly how many calories. And it, you know, it ends up being maybe 2,500, maybe 3,000. But I personally find it difficult to eat more than, you know, more than that. Suppose you could like drink olive oil or something that's super high, super high calorie dense. Density. But
that sounds awful.
Yeah. It does. Yeah. A couple of years ago, I was training for triathlons, and I remember I always had a hard time keeping food down when I was either training or racing. And it was, yeah, I always got some GI issues.
Yeah. It definitely, it can be hard. I mean, it's funny, you know, I mean, talking about training, I find that when I training itself, it's like, it depresses my appetite. You know, if I am, you know, if I'm exercising a lot in a day, I may end up eating less calories than if I'm, you know, working a night shift at the hospital and for some, you know, my appetite is, you know, out of control. I don't know if that's just all the extra adrenaline and or whatnot, but that's neither here nor there. But, but yeah, whatever you can eat at altitude is what you want.
I also kind of want to shed a little bit of light to, so obviously this expeditions like this are extremely physically demanding. Your body's physiology is changing. And then on top of it, you and your crew are doing research and collecting data on these expeditions. Can you talk a little bit about kind of like the logistics or the added, I guess, maybe pressures of doing
huge
research?
Hassle. It is a huge hassle. It's what is how I would put it. So, you know, I haven't done that many of these, you know, kind of research oriented trips, but it's, you know, what I have, you know, been trying to do is create a platform for advancing high altitude research by basically, you know, running expeditions where there is a research component. And, you know, we've gone so far as to start a nonprofit in support of this. And unfortunately, COVID really kind of put the kibosh on a lot of our plans, which I think, you know, a lot of people have had their lives kind of upended. But hopefully in the next year or two, we'll be, you know, launching an expedition that will have a strong research component. So the hard part about doing research, you know, in the field is that it's really hard to control, you know, for all the different factors that are at play. You know, it's why a lot of the, you know, probably, I don't know if you'd say best research, but it's much easier to answer certain questions in a laboratory, you know, under those conditions than it is in the field. But the one thing that it is very difficult to do in a laboratory is to keep people in a hypoxic environment for months at a time. It has been done. There's the Operation Everest was a research project that had guys in a hyperbaric chamber for, you know, something like 50 days. I think these guys were in the Navy, you know, so, you know, these are people that you can tell them, hey, you're going to get in this hyperbaric chamber for 50 days and we're going to study you and you're going to exercise and all that. But it's, you know, but it's hard to run those kind of long-term experiments with individuals because they're, you know, most people don't want to stay in a hyperbaric chamber for a month and a half. And there's not a lot of hyperbaric chambers. And the hyperbaric chambers, you know, typically aren't that big. But there are now bigger ones and there are more of them. And so there's some interesting things being done, especially in Europe. But the field, you know, so that's the main advantage that the field has is that it's real world conditions and it's much easier to get larger numbers of people exposed to hypoxia for long periods of time. I don't know if I really answered the question.
That was great. And I'm sure the people already going on these expeditions are volunteering to do it. So it's not like you really have to find participants for a research study either.
Yeah.
Which can be a huge barrier for a lot of research.
Yeah, it is. And most people are, you know, they're happy to be involved in it. You know, I think the one other problems that, you know, in this area though, are things like the fact that you, the population that you might study, it tends to skew, you know, younger, healthier, it tends to skew male. You know, so there's a lot of questions that, you know, you would like to ask, you know, about, you know, older people with, you know, medical comorbidities and, you know, how does altitude affect them? That's kind of harder to address. And then it's, you know, it's hard personally, you know, at the end of the day, when, you know, you're doing all the same things that your, you know, research participants are, and you're tired, you know, and like on Everest, I carried an ultrasound unit and was doing ultrasound exams of people's lungs, looking for the beginnings of pulmonary edema. And, you know, it was really hard to psych myself up to actually, you know, do the examination and fill out the paperwork and all that, because, you know, I was exhausted and I wanted to just lay in my sleeping bag and do nothing. So the volume of data definitely falls off the higher the altitude.
Yeah, I definitely don't blame you.
So I guess piggybacking off of some of these research questions, can you talk a little bit about the research projects you have done? And although they are exhausting out in the field, what's the favorite project that you've worked on? What's your favorite, if you had to choose?
So, I mean, so I haven't done, you know, I haven't done that much, and I'm trying to do more.
So easy to pick a favorite.
Yeah. So I have planned a lot more projects than I've actually executed in the field. So I have a big list of things that I think would be interesting. But I think the ultrasound study was pretty interesting to me. So, you know, this involved just looking at people's lungs, basically looking at four locations on a person's chest. Ultrasound is a terrible modality for looking at the lungs because the lungs have air in them. But when you have pulmonary edema, and the lungs are, you know, more or less wet. There are very distinct signs that show up on ultrasound examination. And so the question with this was, you know, we know that people that go to high altitude, the most common dangerous problem that they encounter is high altitude pulmonary edema. This is a response, you know, one of the, you know, the body's many responses to hypoxia is, you know, when your lungs sense hypoxia, they constrict blood vessels in that lung tissue. And this is an adaptive response in that, you know, if for instance, you had one, you know, lobe of your lungs that had pneumonia, you know, and it's all plugged up with mucus and infection, it's not exchanging oxygen well. And so, you know, this is a response that constricts the blood vessels in the hypoxic area of the lung and shunts that blood to areas of the lung where you do have good perfusion and you are absorbing oxygen well. But at high altitude, all of your lung tissue is hypoxic. And so you get this global hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction, and this increases pressure on the right side of the heart. And that increase in pressure basically leads to a hydrostatic leaking of fluid through capillaries. And the lung interstitium gets basically waterlogged, and it increases the distance between capillaries and the alveolar space, which decreases the amount of oxygen diffusion, you know, and in worst case scenarios, you know, you actually end up with fluid that may, you know, actually turn a little bit bloody, actually accumulating inside the alveoli, and people will start to cough up sort of the classically, it's like a bloody, frothy sputum. So the question is this a spectrum where if we were to be looking, we would find that some people are, you know, developing extra amounts of fluid in their lung interstitium before they have symptoms of pulmonary edema? And does that, you know, would an ultrasound examination of the lungs correlate with blood oxygen saturation? And this was not my idea. You know, I decided to do this because I read somebody else's paper, you know, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And it, you know, I think the paper that I initially had read, you know, like many of these papers, is extremely small sample size. And it did appear to show that there was a correlation between signs of what we call extravascular lung water and a decrease in blood oxygen saturation. So, you know, from basically sea level to then Kathmandu, which is 4,000 feet or something, and then all the way up to I think what was my highest altitude was like 26,000 something feet. I did these ultrasound exams on people and found nothing. So, which it's funny, I there was just recently another paper published that similarly low, low sample size, and they also found nothing, which I think what that is tells you is that, you know, in young, healthy people who are acclimatizing on what is thought to generally be the correct schedule, you know, of you don't see a lot of extravascular lung water. Actually, the one person that I did see a little bit of pulmonary edema in was actually myself, because I wasn't acclimatizing very well. And I actually developed a little, you know, some pulmonary edema, and I could see it in my own lungs, but I didn't do a proper full examination on myself. So I couldn't include myself in my data set because I felt terrible because I had pulmonary edema, which is a thing that you can recover from actually. And so I was actually able to go to a lower altitude, recover, come back and made it to the summit without any additional issues.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, Andrew.
I was just going to say conducting research while you're suffering from pulmonary edema. That's pretty impressive.
I didn't do the protocol correctly. So I couldn't include that data, but I,
yeah.
You could have made it a case study.
I know I should.
Yeah. So maybe the question is, what is the spectrum of, acclimatization that, at what point, does that pulmonary edema become an issue? But I guess it's probably pretty dangerous to test on people who aren't acclimatized to go up to K2, right? To go up in the mountains and climb.
You certainly wouldn't want to rush people, to get up there to see, what it's going to look like. But, a lot of this research gets done in Nepal, where there is a well-established trekking routes through the areas around Mount Everest specifically. Has a very well-developed tourist infrastructure where people, hike from fly into a relatively high altitude, usually fly into an airstrip that's at about 10,000 feet, and then, spend some, week or two hiking up to visit someplace like Everest Base Camp on the south side of Everest, which is about 17,000 feet. That's a place where there's a lot of people that you can kind of grab and include in these studies. So I'm sure we'll see further studies in the future that have bigger sample sizes. And, clearly there is a correlation between extravascular lung water and a decrease in blood oxygen saturation. It's just, it's typically most easily demonstrated in, people that are having overt symptoms of pulmonary edema.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess my my next question would be what are your future plans? I guess, do you have any other expeditions that you're kind of getting ready to do or prepare for?
The first step is just simply making the decision, and I made the decision recently that next year I'm going to do something. Life kind of intervenes and, there's things like, you got to have a job and you've got to pay off your student loans. And, I think I mentioned earlier that I didn't go to medical school until I was 35. So, I finished my internal medicine residency in 2019. I took some time off and then I, kind of started working, and then COVID hit and, the whole world kind of went upside down for a while. And so the things that I was working on at, the end of 2019, I'm kind of just getting back to that. So hoping that next year we'll get an expedition going and hopefully get some research along with that. I think that one of the things that I would like to do is look at the basically your changes in athletic performance with acclimatization, because there's this question out there of, does acclimatization improve your efficiency? Can you produce more work per unit of oxygen after you've acclimatized, as opposed to when you, first arrive at high altitude? And there are, published papers out there that contradict each other in their findings. And so it's, I guess the kind of thing I'm always looking for is, what's a good study that somebody else did that, you know, maybe was underpowered, you know, or that there, you know, people have found different results. Because then you kind of, you have your protocol, you just say like, well, let's do what they did, but let's do it with more people, you know, or, you know, and hopefully together, you know, we can kind of come to a consensus on what the data is showing us. Because I think for the most part, you know, any one study that's done in the field is always going to be underpowered. And so I think there's a, it would be wise, you know, to just replicate, you know, some of these protocols, you know, over and over until you end up with a big enough total sample size that you can really start to draw some conclusions. And I'm hoping to, you know, encourage other people to do the heavy lifting. You know, I would love it if other people would, you know, come up with their own research ideas, and, you know, we could just help them with the logistics of, you know, managing an expedition and recruiting participants and stuff like that. And that's what, you know, that's what this nonprofit was kind of started, was designed to do, you know, basically to create a platform where there would be expeditions with people that can be studied in the field. It doesn't have to be me. I don't think I want it to be me, you know, all the time. It is a lot of work, but I want to know what the answers are.
Yeah, we can just have one Dave Olson case study after the next.
Yeah, right. How many places can I have pulmonary edema? Yeah.
So what is,
that was a long answer.
Yeah, no, it was a great answer. Just kind of thinking about, you know, you're talking about life getting in the way, you know, I can't imagine it's easy to prepare for these expeditions, especially when you have a full-time job. I mean, I've known some people who have even just planned to do, you know, big through hikes on the PCT and the Appalachian Trail. And it doesn't just take a lot of time to plan, but it takes a lot of time to execute. So yeah. What is your life as a physician? What does that look like as you go into some of those planning stages?
I mean, I am literally figuring it out as I go. You know, I have a full-time job right now, mm-hmm. and, you know, basically to go on an expedition, I'm going to have to just quit my job, you know? And so I'm kind of thinking ahead and trying to figure out how to get myself out of my job without burning bridges, and hopefully with the ability to come back into my job at some point in the future. But it's, you know, yeah, that's definitely a balancing act. Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of has different ways that they do this. I mean, there's not a huge number of people that, you know, go on expeditions, go on climbing expeditions, period. And then among the people that do, there's only so many avenues that lead people to that. You know, some people are, you know, top of their game, well-known, you know, alpinists who, you know, are basically paid to just continue doing what they do, you know, go on expeditions, climb new routes, take pictures with North Face gear on, etc. Then there are people that work as mountain guides, you know, so they are, you know, earning an income from doing this. Then there are people that just have more money then they know what to do with, so they don't have to worry about the kind of normal constraints that other people do.
Sounds like a terrible problem to have.
Yeah. Well, so unfortunately, some of these people, they have, you know, more money than sense. And, you know, especially in places like Everest, there are a lot of people that probably, if it was strictly a meritocracy, you know, and, they wouldn't be there, you know. It's they're, you know, they're paying their way to the top kind of thing. And And so I'm trying to kind of fit into some other category, you know, where you know, I'm able to arrange my work life, you know, in balance with this kind of stuff, and allow myself the time to go on expeditions. You know, when I was younger, it was always a struggle. You know, we'd always try to find sponsorship, try to find people to, you know, give us equipment for free, you know, give us money if, you know, if we could find it. You know, part of the impetus to go to medical school was to have a day job that would make the economic end of things a little bit easier. The irony, of course, is that, you know, you go into so much debt getting an advanced degree in this country that you then, you just kind of have this new constraint, you know, of having to pay off all these debts.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'll wrap up on one last question. Since we're talking about high altitude physiology and exercise at high altitude, I guess kind of piggybacking off of that, I think the areas with which we live, you know, on the kind of western side of the states where we have an abundance of tall mountains to climb, do you have any advice for people trying to get into the sport of climbing? Because I always find it really interesting. It's not something that was an avenue for me growing up. But what advice would you have?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's something that I kind of, I think, took for granted for a long time because I was introduced to it by my dad. But, you know, my wife, for example, you know, she kind of complains to me about how, you know, she was, you know, interested in climbing, and it's pretty easy to get into, you know, rock climbing these days, right, especially with the proliferation of indoor climbing gyms and stuff like that. Yeah. But getting into mountaineering, it can be difficult if you don't just, you know, happen to know people that can, you know, that you can start getting out with, that you can, you know, learn things from, you know, and that you can be mentored by. You know, in Seattle is a little bit different in that there is an organization there, which you may or may not have heard of, called the Mountaineers, which
in Tacoma.
So, well, there's a Tacoma branch, yeah, but it was started in Seattle, and Seattle, okay, is where the main branch is. Their headquarters is now over in Magnuson Park. Or not. Okay. Wait, is that right? Magnuson Park? Sorry, it's been a little while since I've actually lived in Seattle. But in any event, the Mountaineers Climbing Club that was started in Seattle in the early 1900s to do things, you know, to bring people together that liked to get out and mountaineer, and also to do things like import, you know, fancy gear from Europe, which, you know, back then was the only place that you could get something like an ice axe, for instance. And they do have climbing classes. Their basic mountaineering course is something that can be done either over a long period of time, or you can do a sort of intensive version where you, there's classroom instruction, there's field instruction, and then there's, you know, going out and going on climbs. And it's a place to meet other people that are climbers. It's a place to learn things, and there's always trips you can kind of hop on. And so that, I mean, that's kind of the most direct avenue to getting into mountaineering. For people that are interested, is to look into the Mountaineers.
Yeah, that is wonderful advice. I think it's easy to, you know, I go to a local climbing gym, but I think it is hard to, I think it's hard just to get the guts to go out and do those expeditions, right? Because, you know, there can be a lot of safety issues with it. But yeah, that is wonderful advice. Andrew, unless you have any other questions.
I don't think so. I just really appreciate you hopping on and having this conversation with us.
It's my pleasure. You know, everybody likes to talk about what they do. So
yeah,
I could go on and on. I hope I answered all the questions.
Yeah, that was a wonderful variety of things to touch upon. So thank you again. And thank you for listening to all of our listeners. And thank you to our guests for taking the time to be here today. Tyler, can you tell our listeners where to find us on the World Wide Web?
Yes, you can follow us on our social medias at Seattle U Kinesiology on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And for more information about our department, you can go to our departmental website at seattleu.edu/kinesiology. And we're also on Podbean and Spotify, where you can share, like, download, and follow all of our latest podcast episodes at Red Hawk Squawk Exercise for Life Podcast.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for today. We want to say a special thank you to our guest and to our graduate student, Andrew, for co-hosting with me. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Be on the lookout for our next podcast episode as we chat with Andy Ho, which is one of our current graduate students, on June 1st at 2 p.m. And he'll be on to talk about our undergraduate program here at Seattle University. Thank you again to our listeners. And remember, be kind, be healthy, and be active.